This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, pandemic and political uncertainty from Wall Street to Washington.
I don't know where the reality check needs to be. It certainly seems like the market needs one.
Wharton professor Jeremy Siegel on the market whiplash in 2020's first half.
There's two great uncertainties. First of all, whether this latest wave is going to subside. And then, you know, let's face it, Joe, political uncertainty is definitely there for November.
The real estate mogul who stands by his bullish perspective, Barry Sternlicht, calling for business to resume.
I mean, I think we should be smart about it, but I think we should get back to work. There's only one state in the country that's 40% of its crisis level, and that's Arizona.
Those stories, plus Uber's in gear for an acquisition and Lululemon's suited up for an at-home workout. It's Tuesday, June 30th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
And there was a line at the food truck outside the studio this morning.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin. And Joe, when you say a line, you mean more than two people at the food truck outside?
There were six people, and it never, when the show starts, they're gone. And I think they have to be at work at six, maybe. Would that make sense? Maybe, and they're getting something before they go in coffee or at work. But they're,
maybe.
It's been a long time.
I was just upstairs getting mine.
Everybody had a mask on. But but there was about six or seven people, right, Max? Six or seven people right out there waiting for...
Were you one of them?
I was not one of them. I was not one of them, although I do have a couple of bananas here that Mac gets me every morning.
Aww.
Yeah, let's go.
First up today on the podcast, June 30th, is the last day of the second quarter of 2020, and it's been a wild one. The coronavirus pandemic and economic shutdown triggered a 38% sell-off on the Dow. Now, halfway through 2020, the Dow has bounced back about 38%.
Becky, what do we have? We could either be up or down. It depends on which average, obviously, too, for June. The quarter is going to be
actually,
big.
It's the last day of the quarter. It's the last day of the month. And we told you yesterday that both the Dow and the S&P 500 had some ground to make up. The Dow had to gain 1.5% to get in positive territory for the month. It did that plus more. It was up by 2.3% yesterday with a gain of 580 points. The S&P was up yesterday by 1.5%. It had a gain of 44 points. So both of those averages now meeting up with the NASDAQ, being on track for a third straight month of gains. And by the way, if you look at the quarter, you put this together for the last 3 months, this has been an incredibly impressive quarter. We are looking at the best gains you've seen for both the Dow and the S&P 500 since all the way back to the fourth quarter of 1998. And for the NASDAQ, it's on its best track for gains since 2001. So we have seen 3 months in a row that have been incredibly impressive. Andrew.
Hey, thanks, Becky. Let's talk about why maybe those gains are happening in some regard. Fed Chair Jay Powell and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, they're going to be testifying before the House Financial Services Committee in prepared remarks. Powell saying, "The economy has entered an important new stage sooner than expected." But he says, quote, "The path forward for the economy is extraordinarily uncertain and will depend in large part on our successes in containing the virus." He said a full recovery is unlikely until people are confident that it's safe to reengage in a broad range of activities. But at least in some parts of the countries, it feels like people are engaging in those activities. In other parts of the countries where they were engaging, we'll see. Maybe they'll be engaging less. Yeah,
it was after the weekend, and we were all part of that weekend, right? And the news flow was not positive, so it's always confounding. You know, you scratch your head at whatever, but, you know, we actually talked about that right at the top of the show yesterday, that I don't know where the reality check needs to be. It certainly seems like the market needs one, but maybe there's times when, you know, we're just, you know, breathlessly reporting the, you know, some of the news. Anyway, here to talk about what we should be watching in the second half of the year is Jeremy Siegel, professor of finance at the Wharton School. And it's good to see you, professor. And you were on, was it 3 weeks ago? Was it a month ago? Because you were, and we haven't gained a lot since then, but you weren't at that time saying that the market was way out over its skis and disconnected with reality. You thought that it was kind of moving in a way that you could justify. You still believe that?
Yeah. I mean, I point out the fact that the 31% increase in the money supply is the greatest we've ever seen since World War II, far in excess of what we had during the financial crisis of 2008, 2009. And this liquidity is just waiting to burst on to the economy if, you know, we can get people's confidence back. You know, we can see this latest wave in Texas and Florida. If we see that, you know, crest go down, the therapeutics in terms of confidence, you know, we had Robert Redfield, who's the director of the CDC, say last Friday, you know, there's probably 10 times as many people have been exposed to the virus as the official statistics. But that's 27 million. That means the death rate is less than 0.5%. Now, that is far lower than what we had feared in March and April. And most of those deaths were before we knew how to treat these patients. It's probably realistically about 0.5% of that now. These are important figures to try to instill confidence.
What if there are more than just bumps in the road on reopening? Would there be a day of reckoning? And phrasing it another way, do you think that the easiest gains in the stock market have already been made, and it's going to be tougher to advance from here if we don't see real progress in the underlying economy? The Fed can't help us forever.
Well, I mean, there's two great uncertainties. First of all, whether this latest wave is going to subside. I think it will, but we're going to have to see, with the death rates continuing to be very moderate or go down. And then, you know, let's face it, Joe, political uncertainty is definitely there for November. And I am more talking about the Senate than the presidency at this particular point. In my opinion, I think the market would welcome a Republican-maintained Senate, even if there is a Biden presidency. I think that would be favorable for the market. The tax cut, that corporate tax cuts are a major reason for a lot of the bull market since Trump was elected. If they're going to be reversed, that's a strong headwind. Now, in my opinion, the liquidity that's been thrown at this economy is probably going to be enough to offset that headwind. And, you know, if it's a Democratic sweep, there's probably going to be more liquidity thrown at the economy. So I'm not bearish on stocks by any means, but clearly this is an uncertainty that faces the market.
Thank you.
Uber now reportedly in talks to buy Postmates. The price tag, $2.6 billion, is coming just weeks after, you might remember, a failed effort to acquire food delivery rival Grubhub. The tie-up would speed up consolidation in the loss-making food delivery sector. We've talked about how they don't make money yet, and that has seen a spike in demand, of course, during this pandemic. Big question about this transaction. If you remember, at the time that Uber walked away from Grubhub, the argument was that they were worried they were going to face antitrust regulators. The question in this case is, to somehow buying Postmates, which does have a smaller market share, would that somehow be allowed? It's always dangerous when you start to publicly talk about antitrust issues when you still want to buy somebody in the same industry. So we will see where that transaction goes, but it does seem like it's getting farther along. The last transaction, of course, those negotiations were far along, too, and then broke down. So we'll see.
Andrew, I was just going to ask you, you know, the Uber question, since we had Dara on the show and he talked a little bit about how it hasn't been profitable, even during this pandemic, when you would imagine more people are willing to pay money to have things delivered to their house than ever before. It just gets back to that issue. And I saw a tweet. This was somebody who was clearly irritated because they'd gotten their food late or cold or something. He said, I don't think Uber Eats will ever make money, because why would I, you know, pay somebody a premium to have my food sit 15 to 20 minutes at the place, then come and have a messed up order delivery? And obviously, that's a frustrated customer at that point. But it does get back to that real question of, can this ever be profitable? Will consumers ever be willing to pay enough to actually make this a profitable enterprise for any of these companies that are doing this? And it also, again, comes back to that question of what happens with the restaurants. Right now, restaurants are under so much pressure, and that definitely takes a cut of what they would be getting is when they have to share with Uber, too. And I think that's a bigger question than ever before.
I think there's a real question about whether it's ever a profitable business. But I think if you look at Look, if you look at the Uber Lyft example and you look at just in straight markets where on the driving side, it does seem to it can be a good business. I think part of it is there are in the food business in particular. Now, it's great for customers, terrible for the businesses. There really is too much competition. Right. There are too many back end systems that need to be supported. There are too many marketing budgets that need to be supported. There are too many support systems for the restaurants that need to be supported. And so if you could consolidate that, arguably you could turn a profit. The question is whether Postmates actually is even big enough relative. I mean, Grubhub actually was a much bigger player. And so you could have seen how that could have worked. Again, does that mean that the price has to go up ultimately in terms of what we all pay? Maybe. I think their hope is that if you could take out so many of those back-end costs, which there are a lot of, especially given all of the discounting that's going on as well, that maybe that would change the dynamic.
I mean, it's kind of annoying for normal people. It comes up the works. Like when I go, I'm getting some French fries. That's all I'm getting at Wendy's. And I can see on the board who these people are. And it's got little, you know, they got their like their moniker, whatever it is. You can tell that they're guys delivering it.
Yeah.
And I watch them go out with shopping bags full of chili and sandwiches and this and that and this and that. So I'm just like waiting, watching these things get filled. So it comes up the works. I'm not a fan, Sorkin. I'm willing to go myself. I don't need someone bringing it. No wonder it's cold. I think they're getting how many orders at a time to deliver to people as well, right? So by then it's like the pizza guy.
They're doing about three orders an hour. On average, three orders an hour, which is not a lot.
Not two at the same time?
The economics of it.
So it gets, why it gets cold.
No, I'm saying they probably are because they're trying to hit three plus orders an hour on terms of delivery, which in a city, in a densified city, works. Obviously, if you get into the suburbs or even farther out into the country, it becomes harder and much more complicated to get three deliveries out just because of the distances that you have to drive.
Yeah, that's problematic. Yeah. You know a lot about this. I mean, you're not moonlighting, are you? I mean, you don't
just reporting, not
supplementing
income.
Not moonlighting.
Not yet. Not yet. I might need to at some point, but not yet.
You got six jobs already.
There are a lot of. By the way, I'll tell you though. Interestingly, and we've talked about this a little bit. Given the pandemic, the amount of people who are applying to quote unquote moonlight. And frankly, even the types of jobs that some of those people used to have or even have currently or on furlough. I mean, it's a remarkable situation in terms of all of the people who actually do need these jobs. So these jobs actually at right now in this moment, my hat's off to these people because these people at some level are they're not in the health industry, but there's a frontline element to what they've been doing this entire time to keep us all fed and healthy. I do want to talk about Lululemon because it's another big transaction. I know, Joe, I'm wearing my ABC pants today.
I knew you would.
Of this transaction.
Yep. You have not.
But now we're going to have to get you.
You have not. Have you broken from your recent string of every time I ask you, you're wearing them? I mean, I'm thinking maybe you're like me now.
Occasionally I have, well, you know me, I wear those Ralph Lauren suits. I have these Ralph Lauren pants that I wear sometimes, and occasionally I wear AG jeans. Those are the rotation at the moment.
But I mean,
that's
jeans
too much information.
You're right. Okay. Go ahead. Well, ABC pants is too much information right there. Let's just get that out there right from the very beginning because it doesn't stand for the alphabet. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, I'll give you another one, Joe. Hold on. This
Sesame
one you
Street,
should know about.
Not.
Do you know Rhone, R-H-O-N-E? They make amazing pants, very much like this, and I think you'll like the way you look, as they say at Men's Warehouse. Meantime, let me tell you about Lululemon, though, because they do have a big transaction. Their first ever acquisition. It was announced yesterday. They're buying in-home fitness company. Joe, we got to get you one to sit next to your Peloton. It's called the Mirror. The price tag for the deal was $500 million. Mirror will run as a standalone company within Lululemon, and its current CEO will continue to run the business. Reporting to Lulu's CEO, Mirror offers live classes through a wall-mounted Mirror device, in addition to on-demand workouts and one-on-one personal training session. It retails for about $1,500, and subscribers pay $39 per month to stream the classes. It's seen as a competitor to some degree to Peloton, which fell on that news. Big question, of course, is whether being in the apparel business and effectively being in the content production business are the same, and whether you can really marry the two, whether you can sell more merchandise through the mirror, whether you can sell more mirrors through the retail side of it. Big question. Effectively, it's I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's a mirror.
You mean?
It's a two-way mirror with a television, effectively, a flat
right.
screen behind it, and a lot of programming.
Andrew.
You have to watch the
You might see a little too much of yourself. I mean, I'd see a lot of jiggling and moving, and I don't need to see, huh? What?
It's not through the mirror. It's through the looking glass, right?
Yeah, through the. Did you guys, you know, the home fitness? Did you guys see what happened at that Planet Fit? That skeeved me out totally. Down in, I think it was West Virginia. I don't know. 60 people are quarantined because they went to the gym. They're all inside breathing on each other.
Yes, I did see this. I did see this.
Sweating on each other. Now 60 of them are quarantined. I don't know how many got it, but it's like, I don't want to go back there and be right
next
to someone grunting and groaning.
It's the wrong place.
Huh? Did you see the Wall Street Journal story that said we know what this pandemic is most likely caused by? It's not necessarily surface contact, but it is being in close proximity to people who are infected and 15 minutes or longer. That's what they're talking about for the most part. So you think gyms, you think nail salons, you think hair salons, you think all the places we're trying to reopen right now.
Next on Squawk Pod, the real estate magnate who's been bullish from the beginning. Why Barry Sternlicht is calling for states to reopen and business to resume.
There's 17 million people employed in leisure and hospitality. You know where the unemployment rate will drop. It's when the airlines will fly and people will go to the things they did before.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod from CNBC. Real estate magnate Barry Sternlicht built Starwood Hotels and Resorts, the umbrella for brands like St. Regis, Westin, W Hotels, and many more, from a small real estate investment trust into a multi-billion-dollar brand that eventually merged with Marriott. In addition to his hotelier experience, Sternlicht is an investor. His Starwood Capital Group has over $60 billion in assets under management. He's also chairman of the largest commercial mortgage real estate investment trust in the U.S., which is publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange. He's on the board of Estee Lauder, and he's CEO and chairman of One Hotels, the sustainable and luxurious brand with locations around the U.S. But right now, most of his hospitality business has ground to a halt. Sternlicht has joined Squawk Box 4 times over the last 4 months throughout the course of the pandemic, and he's been pretty bullish every time. Back in March, he likened the coronavirus pandemic to wartime, but still kept an optimistic tone.
It will be finished here, whether it's 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. This is going to be really bad, really fast.
Sternlicht has seen his companies through the dot-com boom and bust and through the 2008 housing crisis. And now throughout this COVID crisis, he's been calling for states to reopen and work to resume. It's worth noting that he's making these calls from Miami. While he built much of his business in New York, Barry Sternlicht moved to Florida a few years ago. Here's Joe Kernan.
Hey, Barry. So you were early in terms of saying, you know, This is America. You know, it's not going to be the end of the world. Things are going to reopen. We're going to have an economy. So we're now 2-3 months past that. How would you summarize what you've seen and what you're feeling right now in terms of either being feeling great, feeling bullish, or saying, you know, we've got some work to do still?
I feel good about my call in early March on your show about a three-month World War III. And we had that. That ended in mid-June. And I'm not really surprised about the rise of cases right now. And the good news is it's decidedly younger people, and the death rate has continued to drop, actually, on trailing averages. And I think in a way the country's sort of getting back to it. The young people decide to go back to their bars, go back to their gyms, go have their parties. And, you know, as you know, the data shows that 99.9% of them are going to be fine. We actually had two people in our office call in. They're both in their 30s, and they had COVID for about 24 hours, maybe 36. Now, there are exceptions to that. I'm suggesting that people who are at risk stay home and that people should still wear masks. But I think we have to get back to it. I mean, we don't really have a choice, and the country wants to get back to work. I've been really impressed with the spirit of the country is just amazing, and people are optimistic, and we want to get back to our sports teams. We want to get back to doing the things we did before. including going back to the office, by the way. I think people talk about working from home, but it's nice to get a different – going to the office is more than just like – it's changing your scenery. It's also – it's a social event, and though you'll be more distanced – perhaps. I don't think it'll be – it's the end of office space as we know it, not even close. So, you know, I'm optimistic. I'm worried. I'm worried about airlines. You saw the data earlier that you saw that the people don't think the airlines are safe, particularly worried about the hotel industry. In the destination cities, the gateway cities like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Boston, and convention cities like New Orleans and Chicago – it's going to be tough. I mean, you know, when are you going to have a convention in these towns? And so we as hotel operators are going to have to learn a whole new operating model, which is a much slimmer staff offering less services in order to survive. And one of the fascinating things about the cycle, you know, which I think is really coming into focus for real estate owners of any asset class today, is that municipalities are broke. And though our hotels were shut by the government, you know, we're still paying full taxes on these hotels as if the hotel was worth what it was the day it was closed. And that can be a lot of money in places like New York. And recently in Tennessee, which is a tax-free state, overnight the legislature, the town, the city, the state, whatever municipality it was, voted to increase real estate taxes 35% on every property and commercial assets. And they did it for 1 year, but as we know, sometimes tax increases are hard to roll back. So it's tricky. It's a tricky landscape. And we need to get our people back. We need to get our people back to work, and we can't hire all these people. There are 17 million people employed in leisure and hospitality, and I would guess they're less than half back. So you know where the unemployment rate will drop. It's when the airlines will fly and people will go to the things they did before, and we'll go back to the sports stadiums, and we'll go back into our hotels and go back on our cruises. So we need confidence, and we need leadership from Washington to get there, I think. We really need to instill confidence. It's not good that 56% of people are think that getting on an airplane is not safe, right? And that's simply not true.
How about office rents in New York City? Take that for example, Barry. So yeah, rents could go. You think rents could go down 25%? Expenses are headed up. At that point, would you be buying New York office space? How long before Barry Sternlicht is in buying up office space in New York?
Look, New York. I was in New York last Monday, Tuesday, and we opened our New York offices last week. New York has incredible spirit and grit, and I think people underestimate the grit of New York. It does have a huge issue, which isn't COVID, and probably not even related to the George Floyd riots, but you have an issue now of safety and perception of safety. And I think crime will drive people out of New York. And I think the movement recently to defund the police in New York City is scaring the daylights out of people. And it's not the tax rate. The tax rate, people choose to pay that tax rate because of the joy of living in Manhattan, which it's the greatest city on earth. On the other hand, they can move. And between the tax rates and the fear that seems to be pervading in many of my friends, I think New York's got trouble. And if the kids don't want to go back to New York, the tech companies won't continue to grow in New York. And they've been driving the New York office market. And WeWorks has to survive because they're the largest landlord in New York City. So New York, I think, we'll see a pause. You're seeing the same thing in San Francisco. There's a massive increase of sublet space on the market in San Francisco. You haven't yet seen that in New York to that extent. And there is some leasing activity, but it's also very low. It's probably the lowest leasing activity you've seen in 10 years. So maybe longer. So I think New York City, I think you have a double whammy. You have an issue on rents, and you know you're going to be in pressure for, for expenses, that real estate taxes. As I continue to tell my team, you know, buildings don't vote, people do. So they'd rather do anything than increase home residential taxes, but they will increase taxes on commercial assets. There are two big events coming the second half of the year. The vaccine, which hopefully will be here by December, and I'm pretty confident we'll have one. And then the election. And the shift in the election is going to be, you know, from COVID to election is something we're not yet dealing with. But, you know, Biden's going to increase taxes. He's telling you he's going to increase taxes. And if the Democrats sweep the House and the Senate, you have a whole nother landscape for the market to deal with. The hotel sector is really, you know, people are aware of retail. I think the hotel sector, we and many people got loan forbearance for several months. That's going to come up in a month or two, and then we're going to have to start paying interest expense again. Will the banks forbear? They don't really want the assets back because they're going to have to carry them. They're not break even. They're losing money because you're covering real estate taxes, insurance, workers' comp, health benefits if you're choosing to do so. So I think the banks will be constructive, and I think we will be, the industry, the non-bank lending group will be constructive. But I think you're going to see a long chapter, and that's why we need to get people back out. We need to get them on planes. They need to go back. By the way, some of the hotel industry is fine. Like high-end resorts are fine. Low-end hotels, we have a chain of 24,000 keys running 84% occupancy.
Barry, but don't you think that there's an irony in the goal of reinstilling confidence in our economy that we might have rushed too much? You're pushing, I know, for everything to reopen. And look, we all want everything to reopen, but you want it to reopen so that there's enough confidence that people can actually continue to reopen and continue to get back to business so that we're not having to flush more tax dollars into saving companies that can't be saved. And so my question to you is,
Andrew, you misunderstood me. Yeah. I'm not saying we should go back to 60,000 people in a stadium. You know, I don't think we need to have bars open. I don't think we should have gatherings in stadiums for political purposes. I mean, I think we should be smart about it, but I think we should get back to work. We get back to work. We had most of our office in. We spaced our people out. They wore masks in the bathroom. We had one or two people in the bathroom at a time. So I think I'm not saying don't be stupid about this. I mean, I'm just saying I'm here.
Let me ask you a question. But
right
don't
now.
You think that there's a lot? The reason I asked you the question, though, is we've had a lot of business people come on the show saying we need to reopen the economy. We need to push. And by the way, not just push on doing it, I would argue, responsibly, perhaps the way you're trying to approach it. But bars, people want sports. I mean, and there's a push, and you hear it over and over again. Let's push, push, push. And by the way, governors in certain states are doing that, and maybe it's some kind of great experiment, but it's going to come at, the cost of people's health, and frankly, long-term, it's going to come at the cost of our economy.
Well, I don't agree with that, Andrew, at all, because I think if we don't get people back to work and the enterprises back to getting revenues and profits, there's going to be extreme distress in the economy. And small businesses, hotels will go bankrupt, the airlines will go bankrupt. So I don't agree with your thesis at all in that regard. And incomes will start to fall. And if they start to fall, housing prices will drop, rents will drop, and it'll be a vicious cycle that you won't be able to have enough money in Washington to get out of. So I think the only way to get this economy going is to get people out. On the other hand, I'm not advocating irresponsible. And I think, but there's no reason for a store to be closed and Walmart to be open. There's no reason for the lawn and garden local store in your
town. I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying that I think that there's a line at which people have gone over in terms of...
Yeah, but Andrew,
right,
recognize the data...
You want the hotels to be...
The data is telling you that the youth are not going to die, and they're not even going to wind up in the hospital. So if you look at the data, that's what the data says, and the media keeps reporting the cases. They should actually be tracking the deaths and the hospitalizations. There's only one state in the country that's 40% of its crisis level, and that's Arizona. That's the only state in the country that's even close to its capacity... For the ICU units. And we're kind of playing Sweden here. Sweden has less deaths per million than UK. And it is a viable strategy because you can see what they did in Sweden. And they actually screwed up in Sweden because they didn't protect the elderly. So in my opinion, I think some responsible opening is the way to go.
Well, we don't get this perspective. Not a lot of people will say what you just said, but we appreciate
controversial.
We appreciate your perspective. Thank you. We'll see you around.
Thank you.
Squawk Pod. We'll be right back. You're listening to Squawk Pod. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin.
I want to tell you about some news, and it's a cool piece of news. It's an interesting one, and I hope actually other companies, when they hear the news, will consider this. Netflix announcing this morning it is moving 2% of its cash holdings, initially up to $100 million, from major banks to financial institutions and organizations that directly support Black communities. I wrote about this in Dealbook this morning, and the company saying it is in a blog post this is part of their commitment to racial equality. They're turning their understanding into action and believe that bringing more capital to these communities can make a meaningful difference for the people and businesses in them. Specifically, though, and this is the interesting part about it, Netflix planning to hold $35 million of its cash in two vehicles. $25 million will be moved to a newly established fund called the Black Economic Development Initiative, and $10 million in cash will be reallocated to the Hope Credit Union in the form of a transformational deposit. Now, Hope Credit Union estimates this deposit will support financing for more than 2,500 entrepreneurs, homebuyers, and consumers of color over the next 2 years. But, you know, Robert Smith came out with this idea that all companies should be part of a sort of corporate reparations by giving 2% of their profits over 10 years. That's philanthropy. This is actually a commercial opportunity to effectively move money, just cash that's lying around, from some of the bigger banks to smaller community banks that serve black communities. And by default, if you get that money in those hands, they're going to lend it out. And so you really can create new opportunities. It's completely commercial. There's no you get the same interest rate, sometimes even better in certain cases. But it's an interesting commercial opportunity to put people's money where their mouth is, if you will, given all the conversations we've been having across this country about this issue over the past several weeks.
That's the podcast for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern and subscribe to Squawk Pod on your favorite podcast app. Tweet us at Squawk CNBC, and we'll meet you back here tomorrow.
Joe and Becky, I'll see you guys. We'll all see each other tomorrow.
See you in July.
See you in July.